I'm Alex Krainer. I'm a former hedge fund manager, founder of Krainer Analytics. I'm on Twitter under @NakedHedgy. My website is iSystem Trend Following for traders and investors. And I also have a personal blog called The Naked Hedgy, where I post seldom articles about a broad range of topics, including history and psychology and so forth.
Yeah, very important, I think, too. Just remind us where that blog is again.
It's called The Naked Hedgy.
So what, Twitter, let's just start with there. I mean, you know, you and I are both on Twitter. I noticed an enormous great fall. This is about 3 years ago in the number of retweets I was getting and people saying they can't read my tweets, this kind of thing. What do you make of Musk's takeover?
Well, it seems that Musk will be letting a lot of thought criminals out of jail. So I presume that's a good thing. I don't know that I trust Elon Musk any farther than I could throw him. But, you know, I wouldn't want to exclude the welcome possibility that he's actually going to do good on his word. And I think I've already seen some of the previously banned accounts coming back. I've already seen some of the topics that were off limits being discussed on Twitter. So I think if we can tell the day by the dawn, it's a good thing what happened.
Well, maybe. He's a Bilderberger. Nobody really is mentioning this. Regular attendee at Bilderberg. He's also the elite's chosen man to fuse man and machine. That is to say, to sort of get the body talking to computers. So this seems to me to be one of the main reasons why Musk has been so well funded by the banksters, is that he's taken this mission on and he's taken it on seriously. So I wonder, you know, it's all very well, you say knowing the day by the dawn, but it's all very well that he's saying good things now, maybe some accounts restored. But give us a bit of more of an insight, because obviously you've got, an interest in his company, particularly in his various companies that have done very, very well out of the COVID crisis and the move towards, electric cars, an enormous, massive increase. I'm not quite sure what it is. You probably could tell me in his personal wealth, supposed personal wealth, his share wealth, because of that. So is this really a guy we can trust? Bilderberg, what does that tell you about him?
To me personally, it doesn't say anything, you know, because if you can't, you know, he's a Bilderberger. You can see pictures of him shaking hands and rubbing shoulders with people like Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell and so forth. We saw pictures of Donald Trump like that. We saw that Vladimir Putin was a young global leader of the World Economic Forum and so forth. But let's not forget, if you met Edward Snowden before 2013, you'd think the same of him. He's a CIA asset. He was working for, what was it, Kilo Brown and Root? I forget, one of these defense companies. It doesn't mean that a person doesn't have his own views, his own conscience, and his own choices about what impact he wants to make with his lifetime here. So, you know, if Elon Musk at some point acquired distaste for the role that he's been cast in, that might well be genuine. You know, it was genuine in Edward Snowden's case. And
one of the things which is so significant is that there's been a lot of shorting of his other businesses. It's almost as if the elite don't really like the fact that he's managed to succeed in taking Twitter over.
Yeah, that may well be. I don't know. You know, like, I don't know how the messaging flows through the plumbing behind the curtains. I don't know whether he's genuine. I don't know. You know, there's a possibility that he's taken over Twitter to again attract a larger crowd to the legacy platform, because we know that Donald Trump is preparing to launch his own. So maybe the powers that be decided that they don't want people to migrate onto the platform that they can't control. So they made this whole big show about Elon Musk being the knight on the white horse who's coming to rescue free speech. I don't know, you know, like I have to allow for both possibilities, because we won't find out until we find out.
Well, one place where free speech seems to have disappeared out of the window is on Ukraine, and we're getting an incredibly one-sided, rather like the whole COVID crisis, you know, supporting the World Health Organization, supporting the pharmaceutical industry, supporting Pfizer, etc., the pharmaceutical industry. So we're getting a similar thing with Ukraine, but it's really more dangerous in a way, in that, you know, we've now got a potential hot war between NATO and Russia. So what do you make of the way that this has developed over the last couple of months, Alex?
I think it's been extremely interesting. You know, when the war started, I have to say I was very surprised, because I thought that I really genuinely didn't think that Russia would invade. the fact that they did, to me, meant that there must have been a very, very good reason for it, but I didn't know what it was. Maybe I do know by now. It was very clear that the West, the NATO, the United States, the UK, were setting up a trap for Russia in Ukraine, that they wanted to draw them into a sort of a quagmire, so to start to weaken Russia, to eventually destabilize it, regime change it, and then ultimately destroy it and turn it into five smaller republics that would all be, you know, weak republics with lots of infighting, all of them clients of the Western Empire. The fact that the Russians knowingly and deliberately walked into that trap tells me that they must have, you know, Putin has not been impulsive. He has not been reckless. He makes his moves with a high degree of caution. He usually think, well, you know, not just Putin, but, you know, like people who are on the governing team with him, his cabinet, his military leader, his security advisors, and so forth. They think these moves through very thoroughly. They take all the potential consequences and contingencies into account. The fact that they walked into that trap, and not only walked into it, they walked into it with fewer forces than they were taking on, is very important. And I think that the reason is that they were under the impression that the longer they let it go on, the bigger the problem was going to become. And one thing that we found out in the last 2 weeks from that Swiss gentleman who was the one of the military advisors at the NATO and OSCE, and I forget all his qualification, but his name is I think Jacques Beau. He gave an interview at the Gray Zone and another interview, very important for a French radio called, I forget now, a French online radio. Basically, he said that what happened is that on the 16th of February, there has been a very sharp increase in shelling by the Ukrainian forces against the Donbas. So this shelling has been going on for the last 8 years, so that wouldn't be unusual. But what happened on the 16th through 19th February is that the shelling increased by the factor of 30. It increased 30 times. And this indicated that Ukrainians were preparing to advance and to attack the Donbas. So I think that for this reason, the Russians made the sudden decision to invade. And I also found out that even the very commanders of the troops that were ordered to go into Ukraine didn't know that they were going into Ukraine until the orders arrived. So this all tells us that, you know, the invasion may have been planned for a long time, but the decision was taken practically last minute, and it was taken because the Russians were clearly worried that an attack on the Donbas was being prepared, and then that would also entail a very likely attack on Crimea, that the Ukrainians would attempt to retake Crimea by force. So I think that's what basically formed the decision by the Russians to go in.
And if I could just interrupt you, because there's a lot of eyebrows, well, intelligent eyebrows, been raised in Britain, because last August and September we had the pullout from Afghanistan of all the NATO troops. So I remember I was one of the commentators that said, well, I wonder what they're planning next, you know. And also we had an announcement here in the UK across much of the West saying energy prices are going through the roof, although we were scratching our heads thinking, well, why? And 6 months later, we now know why energy prices are going up. We now know why those troops may be not needed in Afghanistan anymore. And so it does seem as if this was pre-planned, that NATO knew that the Russians would have to react if they threatened a serious full Ukrainian army attack on the breakaway republics and Crimea, Alex.
No, this was definitely pre-planned. And, you know, like we know that starting even before the Maidan coup in 2014, that the NATO and the United States and other Western powers were very active in Ukraine, training and arming Ukrainian troops exactly with the purpose of using them as a bludgeon with which to break up Russia. I think it was in August 2020, I wrote an article on my blog, and the title was COVID-19, the banking cartel is running the agenda, something to that effect. And basically in that article, I predicted that the wheels are going to start coming off of the COVID-19 agenda because it was so ridiculously incoherent that it was only a matter of time before people would start waking up to all the untruths and problems with that agenda, and that these quote unquote elites in power had anticipated the pushback because they pretty much said so in the 2010 article brochure by the Rockefeller Foundation, where they basically laid out the whole plan. They anticipated the pushback and they prepared diversions to misdirect people's grievances towards other problems. And I said that the most effective means of diversion would be a war, so that we should probably expect in the near future to see military escalations either against Russia or China or Iran. And now we see that this is exactly what's going on. There's another very, very important reason why the West is obsessed with destroying Russia, namely, far and away, the most important imperative of the Western Empire is to maintain their hegemony over the Eurasian landmass. And that means that they have to prevent any rival power from being able to challenge them. And so now that we have Russia and China, who have arisen as rivals for the domination of Eurasian landmass, it is the question of the empire's very survival that they try to destroy both of these nations, and particularly dividing, breaking up their alliance. And so I think that the Ukraine was designated as the bludgeon with which to accomplish that, and Ukrainians as the cannon fodder. So they've been armed, they've been trained, they've been how do you call it, quote unquote, educated to oppose Russia, to hate Russia, and to eventually, you know, go to war against Russia.
So what about the fuel and energy situation? Because I think there's quite a lot of people concerned that this increase in prices is something that, you know, is the last thing that people can bear. It's almost as if it's a deliberate way of forcing people down into poverty. And anyway, what do you make of it? Because it's, I mean, these sanctions are almost, it's almost as if the West is delighting in piling on sanctions, which are hurting its own population.
Well, you know, this is all very closely related with the Great Reset, because as you're probably aware, a very important part of the Great Reset is to substitute the Western the energy component of the Western economies from the fossil fuels to renewable energy sources, and part of the reason for this is because the bulk of the remaining crude oil resources, reserves, sorry, is now controlled by Venezuela, by Iran, and by Russia. And the West does not control either one of those three nations. And so, you know, in order not to find themselves dependent on their geopolitical rivals, it would be extremely important that they cut off that energy dependence and that we all start, you know, relying on solar panels and windmills for our energy uses. But, you know, that's a little bit deranged, because while you can use those energy sources to charge up your phones and computers and, you know, run home appliances, perhaps you still need diesel to run your tractors and locomotives and your trucks and your cars and your buses and so forth. You still need coal to fire up many electrical power plants. You still need natural gas for heating and cooling and for industrial uses and so forth.
Well, people like Boris Johnson are pegging their hopes on nuclear, in fact.
Well, that is legitimate, and I think that there are, my understanding, you know, like I'm not a nuclear scientist, but my understanding is that, you know, like the science of building nuclear power plants has advanced, that we can today build much more effective, much safer nuclear power plants. I think that the Russians and the Americans have developed a new generation of nuclear power plants that are much more efficient at using up the energy from those uranium rods that they, you know, the old technology that they used to build all the power plants on, you know, like the old 1940s, 1950s General Electric technology, they use up only 10% of the energy that is available in those fuel rods. The new technologies potentially can use up 100% of that energy, and then the nuclear the waste is then no longer as toxic as it is today. So it would, you know, like instead of decomposing in 10,000 years or whatever it is, it may decompose in as little as 100 years. I forget the exact figures, but I was once in a conference where a German nuclear scientist was presenting this. And so, you know, if a well thought through, constructive approach was taken with nuclear energy, I think that could be a part of the solution. But I'm afraid that these, you know, like these solar and windmill things it's unrealistic, it's expensive. Without state subsidies, it doesn't work at all. It depends on companies that receive state subsidies. That when the state subsidies are withdrawn, some of these companies go bust. When they go bust, you can no longer procure, you know, the spare parts and the servicing, and the whole thing is a shambles. So I don't think it's realistic. Nuclear, maybe.
What about the whole situation with food? Because, as you know, Ukraine is an enormous producer of food. Russia, massive, you know, grain, oil. The food situation is incredible, really, that we would decide that we're not going to import food from one of the biggest food producers in the world.
Well, it's not just that. It seems that the leadership in all the Western countries have made a suicide pact. And of course, you know, for the suicide, they're not, you know, it's not the parasite class on top, but they're volunteering everybody else for that suicide. And I can't quite explain it to myself. You know, unfortunately, this is one of those things that we have to theorize about it. But it seems to me that they are so keen on having us all on these conditional freedom passes that they have created, you know, with the COVID vaccines, that I think that the next step would be to induce a famine and to ration food and to say, like, all right, you know, like, if you want to get your ration of food for this week, you're going to have your QR code, your, you know, vaccine certificate, whatever they're going to have in store for us. And then, you know, people would have to, you know, obey whatever the rules are in order to procure food. I don't know how to explain it any other way, because while at the same time they're mounting wars against Russia and against China, they are at the same time attacking their own populations. And this cannot be by accident. I mean, it's discernible in advance that there's going to be major food production and distribution, and everything they're doing about it is only making things worse. And then there's even suspected sabotage, because in the last few weeks, about 20 food processing facilities in the United States mysteriously caught fire. And we saw that, I think recently I saw that in Belgium, one of the major meat processors announced that they were going to reduce their capacity by 40%. We've seen ads by the British government offering farmers cash payments to get out of farming. Similar offers have been made by the U.S. government to the American farmers. It's absolutely surreal what they're doing, and it's clear that we already have a problem, and they're making it even worse. So, you know, that's difficult to explain. And so, you know, I venture the theory that they are inducing this famine in order to make the population dependent on the government, and so that they could force all kinds of, you know, rules that would increase their control and give them the ability to micromanage the population. And then, you know, the eventual objective of all this is to remove cash from circulation, to force us all onto central bank digital currencies, and then have all that run by algorithms that are going to, you know, condition every transactions with your social score, with your vaccine compliance, with your rations of this and that. So, you know, like, if tomorrow Tony Gosling goes to buy a steak, there's going to be some algorithms who's going to say, like, no, Mr. Gosling, you've already had your weekly ration of protein. You may have some crickets instead, or, you know, whatever.
Well, look, talking of restricting civil liberties, what you're saying there has echoes of the Chinese social credit system. And although there is a lot of disinformation about China from the Western media, there's obvious attempts to demonize China. You can't pretend that what's going on in Shanghai, Beijing and places now with these further lockdowns, I mean, the idea of the people are being locked in their homes, having electronic devices put on their homes to stop them leaving, having, you know, all the measures that have been taken over there, including shipping entire neighbourhoods out, hundreds of people, hundreds of miles away, so that an entire neighbourhood can be disinfected for the latest variant of COVID, which is, you know, basically it's actually quite a mild version of flu. It's not even a bad flu, which the original COVID was. What on earth is happening in China? It looks as if they're way over the top. They've reacted far, far too strictly, and they're sticking to this whole zero COVID policy when it's clearly being used to destroy liberties in China.
Yeah, I must say I'm very perplexed about all this. You know, I starting point, I don't believe anything I read in the Western media, particularly not about China or Russia. But it does seem that something terrible has gone on with this zero COVID policy. I don't have an explanation for why that is. I'm pretty sure that it's not to eliminate a virus. I mean, nobody's that dumb. You know, you cannot eliminate a virus. And the zero COVID policy absolutely makes no sense. We know from, you know, a large body of public health research and science that's, you know, accumulated over decades, that the way you treat epidemics is to do the least to upset the normal functioning of the society. So, you know, any approach should be done with light touch, with, you know, preventive care, with you know, maybe you put people who are ill in quarantine at the worst. But this, what seems to be going on in China, I have no explanation for it. I think it's ultimately destructive, and I'm genuinely puzzled by the whole thing.
I mean, some might say the Chinese government are just preparing their population for the sorts of measures that might have to be taken in an all-out biological war.
Well, you know, I heard those explanations, but honestly, I'm very suspicious of those explanations, because, you know, it seems that the Chinese and the Russians believe or suspect that all these biological laboratories that have been set up around their borders over the recent decades, that part of the research has been to develop biological weapons that target specific genomes, you know, that they can target the Slavic people, you know, the Russians or the Chinese people or so forth. I honestly, I don't know if this is realistic at all. And maybe they know something that I don't know, but I believe that it would be extremely difficult, or not impossible, to develop something like that that would just target the Chinese, but not the Americans, not the Indians, and so forth. You know, like, we have 99% the same genes as a field mouse, but how different is the genome between the Chinese man and a Caucasian man? And can you really target that little bit of a difference effectively and then wipe out a whole population? I wonder if the Chinese aren't using this zero COVID policy as a smokescreen for other ways of attacking the West. You know, like, for example, they blocked shipments of cargoes out of Shanghai. They have disrupted the delivery of parts for Apple computer. Like, I can't explain it to myself, but I think that a lot of stuff that's going on is covert asymmetric warfare, and obviously they're not announcing the whys and the hows of all these things, because obviously they have to be done in a way that conceals the real objectives that they're trying to attain.
Well, that's our job to try and pick this stuff apart. Look, what about since I last spoke to you? We've had the removal of the Chelsea Football Club from Roman Abramovich, who, of course, is Jewish. This reminded me when it happened of the 1938, you know, the removal of assets from the Jews by Hitler. And we have a problem with Nazis in Ukraine, most definitely. If you look at the ideology of the Azov Battalion, the Pravi Sector Party, etc., there's an armed wing basically of a pro-Nazi party. This is not neo-Nazis; these are pro-Nazis. All sorts of not just symbolism, but kind of Nazi ritual. Fascist salutes, all these kinds of things going on there. So what do you make of this? I find it difficult because Zelensky, being a Jewish, I think the first Jewish president of Ukraine, presiding over basically these Nazi units and the confiscation of Jewish assets in London. It seems like some kind of repeat of the 1930s and 40s.
Well, yeah, but, you know, to be fair, they, you know, I don't think they confiscated Abramovich's assets because he was Jewish, but because he's Russian also. That's like a double whammy. You definitely have a very rabid Russophobia being cultivated in the West, but, you know, not just now, since Russia invaded, but for pretty much for decades. And if you read Western newspapers or watch news in the West, you will never, ever, ever come across a story that sets Russia in any kind of a positive context. A few years ago, I saw a speech by Vladimir Posner, who had paid a group of researchers to go through the archives of the New York Times for over a 3-year period. So I think that was 2014, 2015, 2016. And he asked them to look up all the stories about Russia and to try to find any that were cast in a positive context, that, you know, like it was positive about Russia. And they could find absolutely none. So, you know, that doesn't happen by accident, you know, like there would be positive things to report about Russia if you wanted to, but if you don't want to, that's how that happens. So I think that this has been pretty much the rule for Western reporting about Russia, so that we never hear anything good about Russia, only bad things. And so I think that this is what forms the culture and the conscience of the Western world, that we are, you know, kind of conditioned to think of Russia as a dangerous place, to fear Russia, and to be, you know, let's say, willing to give our consent for a war against Russia. And I think that particularly with you asked me about Ukraine, it turns out, the problem of Nazification of Ukraine was really much, much greater than we really knew, because obviously, you know, a lot of this wasn't being reported in the West. There have been some good reports and documentaries, but generally they're not widely talked about. And so we know that now that the NATO instructors that were active in Russia, there were like something like 10,000 NATO instructors there, that they trained many, many, many battalions of Ukrainian troops, and kind of indoctrinated them in the far right ideology. And the parallels with what has been going on in Germany during the 1930s are very, very interesting, because, again, you know, like you had this process that Germany was kept in a state of permanent crisis for 2 decades, from, you know, between World War One and World War Two. And, you know, what happens is that, you know, like there's low employment, there's, you know, young people find no future. And then you come in with capital from the West and you start building up the heavy industries and the armaments industry. And you also start rearmament process, but it goes along with ideology that then gives attracts young men because they're deprived of the future. They're deprived of a way to find their affirmation in life. And now you give them this ideology about a great nation. You give them the opportunity to be part of something bigger than themselves. And, you know, like you infuse them with this passion for the great nation. You cultivate a certain fanaticism. And all of this was going on in Ukraine, but particularly after the 2014 coup. And the fact that Zelensky is Jewish is not all that relevant. You know, like his political patron, the oligarch Kolomoisky, he's also Jewish. He's basically been the key financier of these Pravi sector and Azov battalions. And these people have pretty much told Zelensky that he's going to do as they tell him, not, you know, like he ran on a platform of making peace with Russians, of normalizing the situation in Ukraine. And they told him, you talk to the breakaway republics, you make peace with them, we're going to kill you. And but we know that both him and the previous president, Petro Poroshenko, were threatened with death if they make peace with the Eastern Ukrainians. So the fact that somebody in that equation is Jewish doesn't really change very much.
Okay, how do you know about those death threats?
Oh, they've been reported. They've been reported, and I don't think they're even controversial. I think it's pretty much accepted even in many of the Western media that happened. I don't have it. I couldn't write off the top of my head direct you to a source, but I don't think it's really controversial.
It's got to be taboo. You know, we cannot in the West. We can't admit to supporting a force of Nazis. I mean, we're talking about many thousands of soldiers here.
Well, I think that it's pretty much the way the leader of the C-14 gang, one of the Nazi paramilitaries in Ukraine, put it. So he gave a press conference a few weeks ago. His name is Yevhen Karas, and he pretty much said, "The West is training us and arming us because we are the only one that are willing and able to carry out their orders." And he said some really ugly things in the process. He said, like, we enjoy killing, we love to fight, and that's why they like us, and this is why they support us. And he was saying, we have so much weapons, we have more weapons that we know what to do with, and we got more coming, and they're funding us. And, you know, like, that's that press conference is still somewhere online, and I think that it's been seen by many, many people. And you know, like, the whole thing is undeniable by now, because there's so much video footage. There's so many of these interviews and statements by these people, because recall that these Nazis, they're not shy about saying explicitly what they're about, what their objectives are, what their philosophy and ideology is. And this footage is everywhere, so it's very, very difficult to deny. And then they also, say openly that the West is funding them, that the West is helping them, that, you know, like, American and British and French instructors are training them, and that their objective is to go and fight Russia, and they're, you know, like, they're fighting for the white race, for Ukraine free of Jews and whatever other groups that they they hate. But, you know, I don't think that's even deniable at this point.
So where do you think this conflict is going? How long do you think it'll last? And will it go nuclear? Ultimately, could it turn into a third world war, Alex?
Well, I think in a way it already is a third world war. And I think that where it's going from the Russian point of view is it's going to total victory. So, you know, like the Russians have set their objectives and they are, you know, methodically, step by step, executing on the plan. And apparently they're doing it very successfully. The West will try everything to sabotage this, and they will do everything to prolong the conflict because the West's objective is to weaken Russia, to destabilize Russia, and to ultimately try to regime change it. I don't think that the West is going to be successful with this. And so, you know, many people who observe the situation expect that the NATO will try to pull some kind of a false flag attack that could then galvanize, you know, all the powers that are sitting on the sidelines, you know, well, basically Germany, Poland, France, all the NATO nations that are unwilling to commit to fighting Russia, that maybe that will galvanize everybody to go and make it into a World War III. Will it go nuclear? I certainly hope not. And I believe that it won't, because while there certainly is a very, very small segment of leadership in the West that is willing to take that step, you know, they would have to get the professional soldiers to execute it. I don't see it happening very easily.
Well, look, not easily, no. But if you go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, I can remember reading a book, I think it was called The Limits of Safety, many years ago, probably 20 years ago, where it was pretty clear that there was, you know, I think it was General Power and some of his friends, I mean, amazing name in the US Strategic Air Command, that really did want to start a nuclear exchange with Russia. They said we would win such an exchange with no more than expectable casualties.
Yeah, you know, there's going to be deranged people like that in, you know, like on every side of this conflict for sure. But I think that now it is clear that there wouldn't be a winner to this conflict. And I don't know this for sure, but I've heard some military analysts, Western military analysts, who said that Russians are not worried about a nuclear attack from the West, because apparently they're saying that their defenses are such that probably nothing would come through, really. But the West now also appreciates that Russians have weapons that can deliver nuclear attack that West does not have a way to defend against, you know, because you have these hypersonic ballistic missiles that carry multiple nuclear warheads on other hypersonic missiles, which can strike with extreme precision, that West simply has no answer to. And Russians have pretty much made it clear that they'll be striking the decision-making center. So, you know, you could expect things like this to drop on the MI6 headquarters, on the CIA headquarters, and I don't know where else. But, you know, I don't think that anybody in the West thinks that that could be a winnable equation.
So how long do you think it'll go on for, and how will it finish? Maybe it will finish with negotiation, as the UN Secretary General this week has been hoping for.
Well, I think it'll inevitably have to finish with negotiations because, you know, like every conflict, at the end of every conflict, people have to sit down at a table and draft some kind of an armistice, and everybody has to sign it, and then life goes on. So this is going to happen one way or another. I know that the Russians have planned war crime tribunals for Ukraine, I think, beginning in June. So I think that they are planning to be done with the bulk of the military operations in June. Well, now we've seen after, on Sunday, 24th February, we've seen that We had Lloyd Austin, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, and Antony Blinken, the State Secretary, visit Vladimir Zelensky, allegedly in Kiev. And then 2 days after this, we've seen military escalations in Moldova and Transnistria. So I think that as they're losing the battle for East Ukraine, the West by proxy is trying to now expand the war to the west of the country, to Moldova and Transnistria. So I don't know where this is going to go. I don't know if the Russians, I'm sure that Russians have prepared their contingencies, but we don't know what they are until we see them. So, I don't also know what happens with the west of Ukraine. You know, the Polish are kind of licking their chops about sending like a peacekeeping mission to the western part of Ukraine, maybe with the view of maybe carving out some of the territory and Lvov for themselves, because, you know, historically that's disputed. So they have some claims on parts of Ukraine. So I don't know. I think that the Russians have planned probably to end their special military operation within June, but these other parts of Ukraine, I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, any student of the September the 11th attacks will know that the Anglo-Zionist Empire rather likes these false flags. Would they dare to do a nuclear one?
Yeah, that's the thing that I'm most afraid of. Would they like to orchestrate one? I think probably yes. Would they be able to pull it off? I don't know. Would the reaction in the world be, because, you know, September 11 took many people unawares. And I think that up until some ways into this pandemic crisis that we've had, many people were still sound asleep. But I think that the pandemic caused a lot of people to question what they really think is going on. And I wonder if, even if they managed to orchestrate some kind of a nuclear false flag, that you wouldn't have a lot of people saying, like, no, that's not the Russians, this is the false flag. So, you know, potentially it could backfire too. You know, it could, you know, maybe you had your best, honestest intentions to galvanize the West to go to war against Russia, but then instead you get blowback. And I don't know if these people are smart enough to realize this, but I'm pretty sure that a good part of the hierarchy that they would have to wield against Russia would be smart enough to realize this. So I think that it's extremely difficult to predict, because the system is very complex. I think that a large segment of the population in the West has woken up to, you know, to disbelieve the official narrative. And so, you know, what worked 20 years ago might not work the same way today.
Okay, Alex, can you just remind us whereabouts we can find you online? And also maybe you'd like to plug your book, which was in a way quite prescient, really, looking at the legal attempts, very successful legal attempts in the West here to wage economic war effectively on Russian individuals.
Yeah, so that you're talking about the Grand Deception. So the Grand Deception was published in 2017, and it was promptly banned on Amazon. And so now the only place where people can find it is on the web pages of its publisher, called the Red Pill Press. So the Red Pill Press will have copies for sale, but nowhere else. And then people can find me on Twitter at Naked Hedgie. For traders and investors, they can go to iSystem Trend Following. And for all kinds of other topics, my blog is The Naked Hedgie.
Okay, Alex Craner, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Cheers, Alex.
Thanks,
all right, thank you. So that'll be up on Friday evening.
Okay, cool.
All right. Nice one. Take care.
Have a good evening. Bye.
Thank you. All the best. Bye.